this is Allison Sheridan of the No Silicast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever so slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, October 4th, 2009, and this is show number 226. Well, I'm gearing up for the Blog World Expo in Vegas in about a week and a half. I'm getting really excited about the trip. I am so glad Steve's joining me. That's going to make it like twice as much fun for me. We really do have a good time together, so getting to be out with my podcast cronies and some No Silicast fans out there, it's going to be a great time. So I figured it's probably about time I got serious about writing up that session I'm teaching on podcasting on podcasting. It's going to be great if I get around to writing it. So first of all, you know how I feel about PowerPoint, so you know I'm not going to use that to make charts. So when they told me I had to deliver my charts by a certain date, I sent them a link to a PBWiki thing that I did where I put in bullet points and I dragged in images and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, I went back and looked at it and it looks like crap, actually. It's, it's pretty weak. Didn't do a good job. So I walked away from that and I pretty much just ignored it for a couple of weeks, hoping for some inspiration. Then I was watching a podcast called The Real Deal with Tom Merritt and Rafe Needleman. This is a great show. Two of my favorite CNET hosts. It's not fancy audio. In fact, the video file is like really, really big. It's not fancy video, I should say. But it's just the two of them talking. And they had on the show a guy named Carmine Gallo. And he's written a book called The Presentation Secrets of Steve Jobs. He was a really interesting guy. And he talked about what makes Steve Jobs such an extraordinary speaker. Now, of course, I can't hope to rise to his level, but Carmine did talk about some of Steve's techniques with Keynote, and that's the main thing he talked about was how few words he puts on his charts, how he just kind of gets that aha moment on each chart. Now, I've never really been comfortable with Keynote. I've played with it a little while here and there, and I just kind of like I treat it like I'm using PowerPoint, I guess, and so I decided to give it a try, though, anyway. Well, I launch it. I have to install it because I didn't install it right away when I did the Snow Leopard install. And I got really frustrated because I couldn't figure out how themes work. Like, how simple is it? It comes up with themes. You click on one. Why doesn't it look like it? All I got was white letters embossed on white backgrounds no matter what I picked. I was furious, and I declared Keynote a complete fail on Twitter, and I went outside to play for a while to get over my anger at it. Of course, when I came back, there was a lot of help from Twitter explaining that there were some problems with it. Especially one I got from Mac Find Her, who sent me a link to an article talking about this exact problem and gave the solution, which was to download the new Snow Leopard-friendly version of Keynote 08. I'm not running Keynote 09, so I had to get the update. I did the download, and thanks to Mac Find Her, I was finally able to actually get started doing some content. Anyway, you should check out Mac Find Her at macfindher.com. It's a site with a great attitude about women in tech. A woman after my own heart. Well, now, what I did was I took my entire speech and I put it in picture book form. Most of it I think is going to work really well. You know, who wants to read bullets on what I'm saying, you know? How about a stunning graphic in the background while they actually listen to me and watch my enthusiasm for the subject? I don't need cliff notes on something like this. Show me an image of the feeder logo, for example. I know exactly what I want to tell people, why it helps me do my show, and exactly how. I think this can only work when you actually know your material cold. I have the great advantage of having done the podcasting and podcasting series, and so that's pretty much the basis of the show, or of the class, I should say. So I can tell them that, you know, they don't even have to take notes because after they watch the class, they can just go back and review the material later from the podcasting on podcasting part of the site. Now, the one tricky bit is after I go through all these applications and hardware tools, it'd be kind of nice if they had the URLs to get to those tools. So I made my last few pages are basically a link farm. I gave them the prices of the stuff I recommended too. I'm really having a ball with the whole process, and I think I'll have a much better presentation when I'm done. I don't think the charts stand alone very well, but I'll probably put them up online anyway so the attendees and you can get to them and get to all those yummy little links.
Dumb.
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 Dumb questions.
Dumb questions.
Dumb questions.
How do I?
What is?
How come I always have to?
It's time for Dumb Question Corner.
Dan Eckmeyer has an interesting question about text-expanding programs. Hi, Allison. An app which I've heard a lot about on mainstream Mac podcasts like yours is Text Expander from smileonmymac.com. However, being a voiceover user, due to being totally blind, I don't really get the premise and the idea of how this app would work. I know that you can set up abbreviations for things which you commonly type, and then when you type those, you'll get the full words. Or at least that's my impression of it. My thought is that these would activate when you're just normally typing away in an email, in a Pages document, etc. Am I wrong on that? Is it a case of hitting a hotkey sequence to bring up Text Expander and then typing one of the snippets which I've set up? Do I have the right idea here? It sounds cool, but could never really get an idea on the premise of this app and exactly how it worked. I haven't tried it, so not even sure if it is accessible with VoiceOver. If you could explain it in your next podcast, I'd appreciate that, as I'm kind of lost as to how this app actually works. You may think it's dumb that I don't get it, but I seriously don't. Some explanation to keep to clear the mud would be appreciated. Thanks, and good podcast as usual. Keep it up. Well, Dan, you've hit the perfect sweet spot of the dumb question. Something that escapes your understanding, and you feel dumb asking, but which I guarantee somebody else has the same confusion. I'm really lucky in that I have a lot of blind listeners, so that increases the chances someone else has your question too, and it kind of increases the awareness of the whole crowd that we got to think about these things. I bet there are those who are sighted too who might have the same confusion if they haven't ever used it. So, here's the way it works. You don't have to launch Text Expander or Typeinator or any of the other ones to make the abbreviations work. They kind of run in the background. But what you do want to do is make your keystrokes be something you would never type in regular writing, because you're right, they would expand automatically. So, for example, what I do, I've always been at a loss of when to use the semicolon, never have figured out where it fits, so I never ever use it. So I end all of my keystrokes with the semicolon. That way I know I'm never going to accidentally trigger it because I don't use it in real life. Other people use things like double leading letters. Like to insert the date, they might write D-D-A-T-E, because that's not a real word. You could put punctuation ahead of something. So if you, let's say you did know how to use a semicolon, but you would never write semicolon date, because that's not normal. That would never come up in real life. One of the apps I used to use would actually show you on screen that you had triggered an abbreviation, which of course in your case wouldn't help you at all, but then you could choose whether to accept it or not. I don't know off the top of my head whether Typeinator or Text Expander support VoiceOver, but I can certainly ask. Typeinator does make a sound when it's executed, which is cool. For example, I set up the letters S, L, and a semicolon to mean snow leopard. And when I type the abbreviation, it makes a very pleasant little click noise to let me know I've executed it properly. Typeinator also has a built-in dictionary of commonly misspelled words, and when it fixes a typo for you, it makes this funny honk sound. By the way, these noises drive Steve nuts, so I enjoy them even more. Text Expander also makes a noise when you get a successful expansion. What I like, one of the things I like in Typeinator is you can choose what noises you have play when different things are triggered. This was an excellent question, and I'll let you know if I can figure out whether either or both of these tools are accessible. Our next dumb question comes courtesy of Pierre Bourgeois. Allison, on many podcasts, including yours, mention is made of deleting plist files as part of troubleshooting. Following a recent Google search to fix a problem I was having with a printer, I followed the instructions provided and deleted some plist files. This did indeed seem to fix the problem, but I still do not know what a plist file is or what it does. Could you provide us newbie nerds with some insight on this? Best regards, Pierre. Good question, Pierre. Plist stands for property list, and it's a place that Mac OS X, Cocoa, and also NextStep and GNUStep programming frameworks use to store serialized objects. All right, so that's what Wikipedia says a plist file is, but that probably didn't help you at all. Put in significantly simpler terms, a plist is a file that's created by an application to store user settings. They may contain more than user settings, but at the very least, I do know they do that. So let's say you're an Excel fanatic like me, and you enjoy micromanaging the menu bars, the menu icons in the toolbar. You go into the customized toolbar, and then you drag out those stupid ones for cut and paste, because you know you're going to use a keystroke for those. You're not going to go up and click it. And instead, you put in the one for set print area, which should have been in the menu bar all along, because you need it all the time, and there is no handy keystroke for that one. Well, let's say you go into your user accounts library folder, select the preferences folder in there, and then do a search on Excel. You'll find another subfolder for Microsoft, and in there, a file called com.microsoft.excel.prefs.plist. If you delete that file from the press folder, and then you reopen Excel, all those menu bar changes will be gone. So again, that's where you save those little preferences. It appears to me that developers have a lot of freedom of what to keep in that plist file. In some cases, you can trash it, because for some reason they do get boogered, as your printer plist file proved. But sometimes you can delete them, and there's no ill effects at all. The application runs exactly the same. But in my Excel example, I'd be pretty cranky if I had to throw that away. Just this week, for example, I thought I had lost my Pro key for QuickTime 7. When I called Apple, they told me I could drag my .plist file over from my Leopard backup and into my Snow Leopard install in the Preferences folder, and I'd be up and running. They were right. I was so glad I never got around to trashing that Leopard install. I'm going to have to figure out how to save that because I keep needing it time after time. Now, a bunch of you are probably saying that Apple could have given me my QuickTime Pro license key, and I'm telling you, they looked and looked and looked, and I must have bought it under some other account because they couldn't find it anywhere. I'm pretty sure I could track it down if I wanted to, but I've got it now, so I'll probably get lazy and not do it. So this deleting of plist files is a really nice little diagnostic step to kind of keep in your tool belt. If an app starts acting wonky, just drag the plist out of the preferences folder, and there might be more than one, so use Spotlight to find all of them. Drag them out onto your desktop and see if the wonkiness goes away, and see if you lose anything you really needed before you actually throw it away for sure. Once it's up and running properly, you can toss that bad boy in the trash. Deleting plist is one of the few things that I realize makes the Mac as weird and mysterious as Windows. Whenever I'm about to scoff at someone for the idiotic things you have to do on Windows, like changing the BIOS settings or deleting DLLs, I realize that the Mac's pretty weird and geeky too, so I keep my mouth shut about that. This next segment's going to be pretty hard for me. When I was in high school, someone I idolized turned out to have flaws like any other human. I remember my mother quoting from the Bible that sometimes you'll find that your false gods have feet of clay. Now, I don't mean to wax religious here, and that's not what this is about. It's just about idolizing someone and then finding flaws, and you know how sad that can be. The subject of my sadness is Leo Laporte. I adore Leo. I've met him several times, and I found him to be charming and genuine, and he really cares about people. He finds people really interesting. He's funny and entertaining, and he's great with people who have lesser geekery skills. I listen to Twit, his radio show, MacBreak Weekly, and even Windows Weekly, and I never miss a show, and I look forward to every episode. But there's one thing about which I'm highly intolerant, and that's hypocrisy. Leo has gotten into a mode lately that I see as hypocritical, and to illustrate my point, I'm going to play a couple of sound clips from his radio show. Okay, I know, you're thinking, here's another Apple fangirl angry that Leo said something mean about her precious Apple. Well, I did think long and hard about this before bringing it up because I wanted to soul search and see if that's what really bothered me. I've decided that I'm actually okay with the fact that he doesn't see value in Snow Leopard. That's not the part that bothers me. What bothers me is that he blames other people for what he actually said and did himself. Let me start with a clip from his radio show, episode 589, which aired on Saturday, August 22nd, 6 days before Snow Leopard was released.
$29 upgrade for people who have an Intel processor and a Leopard. That's a pretty good deal. I commend Apple for doing that. They say it's because there's not a huge change between their current OS X Leopard and Snow Leopard. Even the name would kind of imply that. They say, well, you know, Snow Leopard's really polished OS X. That's not quite true. Under the hood, there's some very big changes, some significant changes that will make the operating system easier to use. The Finder's being rewritten. It's almost all 64-bit now. And there's a new language, I guess it would be the best way to describe it, that's for games and video card designers. That's going to allow Apple to do some amazing graphical stuff. Always been a great graphical platform. Snow Leopard's going to really add to that. I think the reason is twofold, bad economy and the fact that people will look at it and say, well, this looks exactly the same. But under the hood, you're getting more than $29 worth of upgrades, I think.
So here, keep in mind, Leo is a member of the media, right? And I mean, he reports tech news. If that isn't the media, I don't know what it is. He sometimes tries to disassociate himself from the media, but that's what media is, right? In some small way, I mean, I would suggest maybe I'm a member of the media if you squint at it just right. So as a member of the media, in this clip, he was not quoting anyone but Apple. He didn't say so-and-so told me. He said Apple the whole time. He talked about how Apple was downplaying it as a very minor update, but that Apple has put all these wonderful goodies under the hood. Note that everything he lists in his description of how wonderful it will be were actually delivered in Snow Leopard. Everything he said is in Snow Leopard. Remember also that in the clip he says, quote, people will look at it and say, well, this looks exactly the same. Remember that quote. Okay, now let's fast forward to episode 591, which aired on Sunday, August 29th, the day after Snow Leopard was released. Here's just one clip of his many diatribes about Snow Leopard.
And I'm looking at the reviews of Snow Leopard. I should summarize these. You know, David Pogue in the New York Times, major leap forward. Or let me see what did David Koch say? Walt Mossberg in the Wall Street Journal. You know, all the positive reviews for Leopard. Snow Leopard. I've got a new name for it. Snow Job. Snow Job. Who are these reviewers? What are you guys talking about? I defy you. Just go into the Apple store today and play with a machine that's running Snow Leopard and tell me what the difference is between it and Leopard. There isn't any difference. It's like it's like an empty box. Here's a disc. Put it in. Ooh, magic. Sprinkle fairy dust. Oh, it's Snow Leopard now. Yeah, there's a few things that could, if Microsoft had done this, by the way, let me tell you, the anger, the vituperation, the swearing and cursing and fuming from these same, you know, David Pogue and Walt Mossberg and Ed Begg and all the big shot Apple journalists. I'm sorry, they're not Apple journalists, are they? Are they? Microsoft ships operating system that does nothing. How dare they? Well, at least Apple's only charging $29 for this. Most, yes, I know there's supposed to be changes under the hood, but if it looks exactly the same, supposedly it's faster. Okay. Supposedly it's smaller. You know how they made it smaller? They don't install all the printers that they installed before. Ooh, it's smaller.
Okay. So let's make sure we understand this correctly. He's angry with David Pogue and Walter Mossberg for saying that Snow Leopard does all of these wonderful things. He accuses them of being Apple journalists. And he actually says, he has the gall to say, there's supposed to be changes under the hood, and he says it looks exactly the same. I'm sorry, isn't that exactly what he breathlessly reported just before it was released? He said it had changes under the hood but would look essentially the same. Then, a week later, he's all mad because it has changes under the hood and it looks exactly the same. This makes me crazy. Again, while I sure would, you know, I'd love to hear him gush over Snow Leopard, it's the hypocrisy of his diatribe that actually gets under my skin. I don't care whether he likes Snow Leopard or not in the big picture, and how dare he accuse Pogue and Mossberg of precisely what he did himself. Okay, I tried to move on. I tried forgiveness. I tried letting these wounds heal, which was really hard since he kept on this diatribe for every single show he does. But I had moved on. But then he did another hypocritical thing that he's done many times before, but that old wound was just a little too fresh, and I had trouble moving on when he did this one. It's a few weeks later now. On his radio show, he had a guy who had a Windows PC that was reporting that it didn't have a valid license. And he tried to validate it, and it would say it was valid, and then, you know, he went around that circle a bunch of times. Well, Leo bemoaned all copy protection and how it just makes life impossible for the law-abiding folks and it doesn't stop the real criminals. I am 100% in agreement with him on this. Then on episode 594, from September 6th, he was talking to Caroline, who was trying to rip some DVDs she'd purchased so she could watch them on her iPod. This is a constant aggravation to many of us where we legitimately buy our media, we just want to watch it in a different form. I agree with him here, too. Let's listen to what he says.
Okay. And I was able to get two of them into my iTunes library using Handbrake Light so that I could watch them on my iPod.
Excellent.
Now, the other two, they wouldn't let me at all. It would.
Yeah. You're did you know, Carolyn, you are now a criminal?
But I bought them even though I'm watching them myself.
But I know.
I didn't.
I think you should have every right to do this. And frankly, I don't think any court in the world would ever convict you of any crime here. But I just want you to know that the Digital Millennium Copyright and the Motion Picture Association of America both deem you to be a criminal for making a copy of your DVD. Used to be protected as a fair use, you know, I can make an archival backup. No, not anymore.
So again, I'm with him 100%. He's against copy protection because it keeps you from doing such normal things. But here's where he made my blood boil. This is the same conversation. He's still talking to Caroline, but he's talking about issues that she may have running Tiger because newer software may not work for her. Listen to what he says.
It happened, I think, with Snow Leopard. It won't happen immediately, but in the next 6 months. Because, you know, you're two behind now. Snow Leopard just came out. So I think for $30, by the way, I'll tell you a little secret. And Apple's not going to like me on this one. Apple says $30 for the Leopard user. You can get the upgrade. It doesn't care what you're running. You could still run it on Tiger. You'll be violating the terms of service. So I leave it to your conscience how you feel about this. But for $30, you can go to Snow Leopard on your machine.
Okay.
Can you believe this? Here's a company that gives you a good, affordable price on their product. They put no DRM on it, so they don't prevent you from misbehaving. So he tells her she can disobey the terms of service. Now, I know technically he didn't tell her to disobey, but he certainly encouraged it. And then he makes this snarky little, Apple's not going to like me for this comment. Well, guess what, Leo? I don't like you for this. I don't want Apple to start putting crapola on our software so that you have to jump through hoops to do legitimate things. I don't want the 5-user license for the family pack to suddenly have protection that stops me from putting on a machine after I wipe the disk clean to start over and makes me have to do some annoying call to customer support to beg for help. I want to encourage everyone to obey the terms of service. Treat them with the respect Apple has shown us by not putting DRM on their software. Every time I think of this, I get so mad I could spit. Shame on you, Leo. I expect more from you. All right, I'm going to try and calm down while we listen to yet another delightful review from Rose from Australia. Be sure to follow her on Twitter, at OzRose. She's hilarious.
G'day, girls and boys. Have I got a review for you? Now, I know the rules of Nasilicast. Identify a problem, then show the solution. Well, I had 4 problems. Well, actually, I've got lots of problems, but this is a family show. Hey, Lucian. So I'll stick to just these 4. Problem number 1. I reckon I'll need to be super fit to store Allison effectively at Macworld, so I'll need a new pedometer. Problem number 2. I loved my little shuffle, the one with the clip, but it started skipping. Most discombobulating. Problem 3. I had lusted after the Flip Minnow since I first laid eyes on it, but they don't ship to Australia. Can you see where this review is going yet? Problem 4. What was I going to buy myself for my birthday? Can you imagine my delight when on 09/09/09, his jobliness answered my prayers and announced the iPod Nano with video camera? I immediately bought a purple 16-gig iPod Nano, and I am rapt. It is, of course, a thing of beauty. Now, the pedometer is not exactly a precision instrument, but it gives you a good idea of what you've been up to. But naturally, everybody wants to know about the quality of the video. I am rapt. You're not going to win at Cannes Film Festival, unless, of course, they have an iPod Nano category. Hey, who knows, it could happen. But they look very good on my MacBook, and it's perfect for posting embarrassing videos of your drunken friends onto YouTube. And it's also good for amazing your workmates. Mine simply couldn't understand how such good quality videos came from such a small unit, and kept on remarking how thin the Nano is. Which is actually one of my worries. It's so small I'm terrified I'll lose it, or drop it down a drain. I was trying to make a movie of several vids I've taken, but I'm shite at iMovie, and Jane's been nagging me to post some videos, so I've just chucked a few onto my mobile Me gallery. Actually, now I'm back. This is weird. Forget what I just said about Mobile Me Gallery, because it won't play the vids. It won't play the Nano vids. it uploaded them, and they appear to be there, but it just says, QuickTime is unable to play this movie. Please try again. I'll have to check this out on the forums and let you know. But in the meantime, I'm trying to set up a Postgres blog. That was very easy. I'm loving Postgres, but it is taking a long time to upload. My internet speeds fluctuate wildly. I'm paying for 8 megs a second, but it varies from 1 to 9. When it's finished, I'll send the link to Al for the show notes. Now, I filmed in several very different lighting situations, some noisy places, and one as I was walking to work. I'm most impressed with that one. I expected much more blurriness. In the nighttime vids, the headlights on cars do flare quite a bit. Hey, did I tell you I'm wrapped in my Nano? I am, however, not real happy with the file type. Most irritating that QuickTime won't play them in the Mobile Me gallery, and Photoshop doesn't like the file type either. Originally, I wasn't at all perturbed about the lack of a still camera. Easy peasy, I thought. Just chuck the vid into Photoshop and click the Import Frame from Video button. Nope. Photoshop doesn't recognise the file type. If and when I solve that problem, I'll let you know. Now, I'm not a video person in general, so I won't comment on file size. I'll just tell you what they are, and perhaps Stevie P could give his expert opinion. They are 640 by 480, and a 40-second vid is 12.7 megs. So all in all, my gorgeous little Nano gets 5 stars and a koala stamp. Jane, are you in the online Apple Store yet? Go on, Jane, you know you want one. Okay, well, I think that's my review finished. Like I say, I am wrapped. So go out and buy yourself one. And I'll keep posting to Postgres. And by the time you get the show notes, they'll all be uploaded. And you can check on the quality of the vids for yourself. Catch yous later.
Well, Rose, your review is, as always, informative, and different, and entertaining. I love the way you try things, stop the recording, and you came back to tell us what didn't work. That cracked me up. I did some sleuthing on the interwebs to try and find your Postgres blog, since you carefully teased us with it and did not tell us what it actually was. Luckily, I'm amazing at Googling, and I was successful. Rose's videos can be seen at ozrose.postgres.com. I'm really curious why the .Mac gallery didn't work, but I do have an easy free option on how to get a screenshot from a video. Download VLC, that stands for Video LAN Client, from videoland.org. You can get it for Mac, Linux, BIOS, and even Syllable. Never even heard of that operating system. I must go load that on VirtualBox, don't you think? Anyway, open the video in VLC and drag the slider to the frame you want to capture. Choose Snapshot from the video menu. As they say in France, le voilà. Thanks again, Rose, for a great review. Now maybe I need one of those. You know, it does have the FM radio, so I can listen to all my children at the gym. Wait, did I mention that out loud? That's a dirty little secret. Well, this week I needed to demonstrate how to do something on the Mac, but I needed to use the tutorial on Windows. This was an easy thing to do because ScreenSteps is cross-platform. I whipped it open on my Mac, I took all the Mac screenshots, I annotated them with arrows and sequence numbers and bright red boxes, and then I typed in all the text to explain each step and why you'd need to do it. When I was done, I exported the file out as a ScreenSteps package file, and I mailed it to myself on my Windows box on another network. Once I was there, I could easily import the file into ScreenSteps on the PC and keep working and editing at my leisure. Any typos I needed to fix were easily done, adding more text to clarify my points, and I still had my happy Mac screenshots in the file. I exported it to HTML, posted the file on a website, and I had happy customers. I love that ScreenSteps is cross-platform. I love that it has one of the best screen capture utilities around, especially taking time screenshots of menus. It works great. And my customers love that I give them an easy-to-understand tutorial. It's all good. If you'd like some of this yummy goodness, head on over to ScreenSteps.com and download the free trial for Mac or Windows. then when you realize you need to own it for more than 30 days, be sure to use the coupon code NOSILLA, that's my name spelled backwards in all capital letters, for 25% off the purchase price of the standard or pro version of Screen Steps. Next up, we've got another one of Evan's reviews. Let's listen in.
Hello, Allison and NoSillaCast listeners. This is Evan from Colorado coming to you with another review of a great iPhone app. This week's app is QStatus from GX5. QStatus is a little app that does one thing and does it well. It is used to update your Twitter and Facebook accounts simultaneously, and of course, you can update them both or one or the other independently. After downloading the app, you open it and right away get a pop-up indicating that you need to set up your accounts for both Twitter and Facebook. Tap Setup and you are thrown into the settings for the app. From here, you can set up both your Twitter and your Facebook accounts using the appropriate username and password. After you enter the credentials for the two services, you tap Done and you are presented with a simple interface. There's pretty much the place where you type your message and the keyboard. Below that, there are several other buttons. You see the word Twitter and Facebook with either a check mark or an X next to them. If you see a checkbox, that means when you send your update that service will be updated. If you see an X, that means that it will not be. You can tap on the name of the service to change it from a check to an X and vice versa, and therefore you are choosing which ones to update. Below that, you see a music note icon. Tap that and it will figure out which song you are listening to right now on your iPhone, and enter the message, I am listening to, and then the name of that song, along with an iTunes link for someone to go buy it. I've not tried this with podcasts, but I assume it will do the same thing. To the right of the music button, there's a little camera icon. As you can imagine, you tap this and it brings up your camera, allowing you to snap a picture, the link to which is put in your message with a link to TwitPic. To the right of the camera icon, you see the menu icon. Tap this and you get a menu on the screen with several options. Settings, which allows you to change the settings, we'll get into that later. Dedicate current song, which opens the Mail app on your phone and puts the same information about what you're listening to and the iTunes link in a blank email message to send to someone with the subject line, dedicating this song to you. The next option in the menu is Add Photo from Library, which doesn't need much explanation. Why this wasn't put under the camera icon, I'm not sure, but if you want to choose a photo from your existing library, this is where you will find it. The last option in the menu is Cancel, which again, I feel requires little explanation. Let's explore the Settings option a bit more. Tap it, and you are presented with the same menu you saw before when you are entering account credentials, and you can go in and change these account credentials if you'd like. Below that is the option to pick a different username and password for services like TwitPic and TwitVid if they are not the default for your Twitter account. There's also the option to change the sound your phone makes when you update your status. There's also the option to change the background, which you see on the main QStatus update screen. There's also the option here to pick which profile picture you see on the main screen as well. You can pick between your Twitter and your Facebook profile pictures. The only other thing in the settings menu are About, which just gives you some information about QStatus, and Help, which when you tap it puts you into Mobile Safari and onto the QStatus Help page. QStatus does not serve as a means of reading yours or other people's updates, and therefore is not a true Twitter client. It is simply an easy and lightweight way of updating your profile. QStatus is available in the App Store and costs 99 cents and is definitely worth it if you find yourself updating both Twitter and Facebook statuses with the same messages at the same time, or if you just want an easy way to update either one of your statuses without going in and being presented with a whole bunch of tweets that you feel you must read. To find out more about what I do, you can follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/vanmo92.
Well, thanks, Evan. Fantastic. I've really got to check out QStatus. One of my goals is to update my Facebook status more often, but I don't want to spam people with every tweet I make because that would be really lame. I mean, could you imagine your Facebook status is updated with LOL? So this sounds like a good option to be able to do both, but do them selectively. Thanks for another great installment of your reviews. So research assistant Niraj was looking for a car. He and his wife Chow wanted to buy a used car, and they were looking at all different models. They came across a Honda CR-V. Well, buying a used car is always scary. You might think the car's lovely, but how do you know if the engine is sound? Niraj and Chow called Honda Bob, and he agreed to come out and take a look at it for them. Now, they had never met Honda Bob before, but obviously he had heard his praises sung somewhere. I'm not sure where he might have heard of him. Bob met them at the car, and he went all over it with a fine-tooth comb. At one point, he turned the wheel sharply in one direction, crawled under to look around, and when he got up, he asked the seller if he'd had the car out in the desert. The guy goes, well, yeah. sounded kind of like Sherlock Holmes, you know, in that one where he sees dust in the guy's shoes and he figures out it's the very dust from a particular construction site where the murder took place. Well, anyway, Narayan Chow got a great feeling of confidence from Honda Bob, and when he gave the car a thumbs up, they knew they had a winner. They bought the car that day, and I think Honda Bob probably has a new customer. If you'd like to have Honda Bob come to your house and maintain your Honda or Acura cars in tip-top shape, and you live in the LA or Orange County areas, give him a call at 562-531-2321 or shoot him an email at hdabob@aol.com. H.A. Bob's mobile service is not affiliated with Honda, Acura, or Honda Worldwide. It's time for that favorite time of the week. It's time for Chit Chat Across the Pond with Bart Bouchas from BartB.ie. How is this weekend treating you? We got a surprise that you get to stay with us.
Yeah, my plans sort of fell apart. Yay for us, but I'm feeling sick. And cranky and generally unwell, so that's not good.
Aww.
But hey, I'm happy now because I'm talking to you.
There you go. We always love that. Well, let's see. Let's start off with, we used to call the security light, but I want to rename it this week an arbitrary code execution.
It's certainly a common phrase, resulting in unexpected application termination or arbitrary code execution. I can say it in my sleep.
Nice. So what is arbitrarily code executing this week?
iTunes. Actually, I wonder if the guys in Microsoft who always write those security things, I wonder if they have a text expander for that. Semicolon AC.
They probably do, right?
It's always exactly the same phraseology. I think if they were typing it by hand, they'd occasionally slip up, but
right,
no.
Right, right. I bet they do.
Yeah.
So iTunes, huh?
Yeah, iTunes 9.0. Basically, you know, one of the most common ways you get these arbitrary code execution things is when you're processing a file of some sort. We have them with JPEGs, we have them with PDFs from time to time. Anything that involves processing a file is potentially prone to these things because if there's a slight flaw in your data validation, you know, you make an assumption that no one would ever do X, Y, or Z, or you forget to check for some idiot doing X, Y, or Z. And that could trip up the whole program and cause you the problem. So in this case, there's a problem processing something called a .pls file.
PLS?
Which is a playlist.
Oh, okay.
Apparently, it's a more modern version of the M3U or the MU3 or whatever that MP3-based playlist thing is called that Winamp used to do all those years ago when I was a Windows user. So if someone tricks you into running this dodgy PLS file, iTunes will try to process it. The PLS file will contain wrong, invalid data, which is invalid in such a way as to trigger a known bug in iTunes. And then they get arbitrary code execution, our favorite friend.
So when you say manipulating files, because the playlist goes out and accesses other files and creates something, can create things?
No, it doesn't have to be. No, it's just iTunes tries to interpret the file.
Oh,
it's
okay.
Supposed to be list of things for it to do.
It's an interpretation step.
As it tries to process it, there's a mistake in the processing code within iTunes, which the file knows about and explicitly triggers.
Oh,
so they know that Apple left out a semicolon somewhere. Apple are assuming that no one would ever do X, Y, or Z. You know, some sort of assumption has gone wrong or some sort of bounds check has been forgotten. They really should have been checking that this was always going to be an integer less than 500, but they forgot to do that check, and actually you can pass in a bigger integer, which later on in the code causes something to go horribly wrong. That's what these things always come down to.
Okay.
It comes down to a teeny tiny minutia of how you process the file, and someone forgot to put in an if statement that says to make sure that something is true.
Okay.
Or false.
So now, if I've got, let's say, now my playlist would all have podcasts in them, but let's say I've got a playlist of IMPs that I haven't heard yet, a smart playlist or something like that. Can I cause that arbitrary code execution thingy on myself? Or
you would have to be the most unlucky person on the planet.
Okay.
The chances are probably one in a squillion because, you know, we know it works generally speaking. It's just someone has gone out of their way. They use special programmers called fuzzers, which intentionally make up bogus data and throw it at programs to see what they do.
Okay.
So you really got to go out of your way to trigger these things. So it is going to be a case that some bad guy is going to figure out how to make the bad thing happen and then specifically craft a PLS file to make that happen and then put that PLS file on the net or in an email or in some other way where they're going to encourage you that you really do want to run this file.
You know, okay, so
PLS file to get to a secret video of someone naked or something. I don't know. But they're going to find a way of making you click on it.
Okay, so the places people get playlists, I mean, there's those things, let's say Kanye West playlist you can get off of iTunes or something like that. They could actually put it in a place like that, couldn't they?
Except how would the bad guys get access to somewhere like the iTunes store?
Well, I was assuming that Kanye West was the bad guy in that plot.
Well, we're not talking music here. We're talking malicious intent.
Right.
Different
right.
kind of bad.
Okay. So,
to be honest, I don't see this as being a particularly big deal. We've had way worse issues. But apparently you were saying some people in corporate America are having a conniption over this one.
Oh, yeah. They were yapping about, we got to take this off. We got to go deinstall iTunes from everybody's machines. Whoa! You know, and my answer was a patch is being pushed out. And everybody sat back calmly. What I didn't point out was it was Apple pushing the patch out.
Yeah, so it's being pushed.
The good news
and in
is
fairness, Apple are good about updates.
Right.
Sort of.
Sort of. In this case, if you launch iTunes, it immediately comes up. If you got iTunes tonight, it comes up with a big thing going, there's an update, push this button. I'm not even going to make you reboot. Please, please, please push this button. So it's a good update.
Exactly. And you have to put this into context. I mean, PLS files are not really all that common. PDF files, they're pretty common. And Adobe has had more of these kind of issues than you can possibly shake a stick at. And for some reason, corporate America don't tie themselves in a giant big knot over uninstalling every copy of Adobe, when really they should, because Adobe is terribly prone to these bugs and has a horrendously poor history.
I do want to make one complaint about Apple and updates, and this is kind of a sideways thing, but like I said...
I don't know where you're going with this. This is a repeat of a previous issue, isn't it?
Actually, no. This is a new one I just had today. So if you open up iTunes... it automatically does a check for updates if you've got it set that way, or you can go under the preference thing or under the iTunes label in the menu bar, and you can say check for updates, and it checks for updates. Well, this morning I had loaded iWork 08 on Snow Leopard, and I've never used it on Snow Leopard before, and I brought up Keynote, and it was just all weird. The graphics were all strange, and I didn't know what was going on. I thought, well, you know what? Maybe there's a Snow Leopard update. So I looked up in the menu, and there's no check for updates. I was just like, so I sent off a nasty tweet about it. By the time I got back from the beach, I had a tweet back saying that there was a problem with Snow Leopard in it, and you could get the update, but that you had to go under software update within system preferences. Now, why with one application like iTunes does it have its own software update like everything else, but with that particular package, you have to go over to software update? Doesn't make any sense.
All the iTunes one is doing is calling software update.
Okay.
They're all coming.
But it's in the standard location where every other app, I mean, if you're running, Acorn or Firefox or whatever, it's under that check for updates thing. And why do they have those applications? iWork has to be over under this other thing. Stupid.
It's just, I guess, they don't expect you to go looking for the updates because they'll just come in automatically through software update.
Right. Yeah, possibly. Yeah, it would have.
Because mine updated themselves.
Right, but I loaded it and it was broken and I was stuck. You know, I wasn't thinking about software or about the official software update. I was thinking, well, why not the application update? Stupid.
Well, Apple does everything through software update. Yeah.
iTunes has the button. I don't care if it calls software update, but iTunes...
iTunes is actually the exception, because I don't think if you go into iCal or any other standard app within the operating system, you can go into Mail, I don't think they have update buttons.
Well, now I'm going to have to launch them and find out. I'll launch something that doesn't make noise, hopefully.
Anyway, I thought you were going to complain horribly because Windows users are being abused again by Apple.
How? Oh, what did they do?
Remember you were whining so much when they pushed out Safari?
Oh, I was really mad about it. In fact, I'm still mad about that.
Yeah, well, prepare to be mad again, because now they're pushing out the iPhone Configuration Manager app to everyone.
What?
You know that app that lets corporations create like profiles and doodads and hickeys and things?
Yeah?
Yeah, that's being pushed out to all users of iTunes.
If you have... Oh, no. Are you serious?
On Windows. Yeah. It's probably being pushed out to us, too. We just don't know it.
That just makes me sick to my stomach. I got to find an alternative. You know, I had heard that there was something else annoying, but the person who sent me the link sent me a link to a like 1 hour podcast I had to listen to figure out what it was about, and I was just too tired.
Yeah, that's too much effort.
Yeah.
Anyway, I thought this was going to be really short because we have a lot to get through today.
Oh, sorry. Okay, so security light is there's a flaw in iTunes. Okay. Say yes when it wants to update to 901, or just go ask for it right now.
Exactly.
Done.
And then you're fine. All good. Exactly. All good in the hood. So the next thing, I just want to follow up a little. Last week, I talked about my saga with NetNewsWire and how at the end we'd made peace. And then by the time you went on air, I had unmade peace again. And I think I've mostly made peace again, but only mostly. I like
as
it to
as NetNewsWire turns.
Yeah, it's like I now know where the mines are in the minefield, so I'm just stepping around them, having blown myself up about 20 times in the process.
So what went wrong after last week, and then how did you fix it?
I started to notice that although I thought I had finally gotten all my subscriptions in sync, some of them seemed to be falling out of sync.
Oh, no.
Which has a bizarre side effect. They don't disappear from NetNewsWire. They stay there, but because they're not in Google Reader, NetNewsWire doesn't know what to do about marking items as new or not because it's trying to keep it in sync with Google Reader. So it just doesn't mark any items as new. So I thought that there had not been a single bit of news from Macworld UK in the last 2 days.
Unlikely.
Then said, yeah, hang on a sec. There's something not right here. Why have I not seen any Mac news? And so I went in and looked, and all the entries were there for the last 2 days, and they were all dated correctly, but none of them had ever been marked as not new. So when I went over to Google Reader, lo and behold, it wasn't there. So for the fifth or sixth time, I hit that merge button under sync, and then it got pushed over. I don't know why it hadn't been pushed over before, or maybe it was pushed over and it decided to delete itself. I have no idea what's going on. But it's, you know, 90% or more of my feeds are staying in sync because the total number at the end of the day feels right. I'm getting, you know, within about 50 of the right number of new entries a day, which is about 800.
Oh, jeez.
Most of those are photos, though. Okay. So you just scan through them quickly because they're coming in from Flickr. So you just literally quickly scan through them and then you just look at the ones that are actually interesting looking. And a lot of them are headlines in security stuff where I just scan through for anything that belongs to a program I care about and ignore all the rest. So at least 500 of those are instantly thrown away. But yeah, I still have a lot of news to read.
No wonder you know all this stuff.
That's the secret. Read stuff.
That sounds like a little too much work for me. I'll just listen to you. You'll be my aggregator.
Human aggregator.
Yeah.
So I definitely, the majority of the feeds are okay, but there's a few stragglers either vanishing or never got in, even though I'd synced many, 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 many times at this stage with that merge button. I don't quite know, but it's not 100% correct. Then there is another bug that I know for sure happens. If you delete folders locally, they do not get deleted over in Google Reader. So you start building up detritus whenever you log into Google Reader.
Hmm.
A whole bunch of empty folders. And to make things worse, this is 100% reproducible. I've been checking this. If you have a nested folder, say, for example, photography, and then nested within inside it, Flickr groups, which, is, as it happens, is exactly what I do have, and one I add new entries to quite a lot. You add a new entry, and you tell it, I want it to go in this folder. It says, do you want to synchronize the little checkbox for synchronize the Google Reader? You click, yeah, sure. You hit go. A new folder called Flickr groups is created at the root level, and the feed is put in there. So then you drag and drop the feed where it should have gone, and you delete the folder. Only you haven't deleted the folder because it doesn't delete.
So now do you have two when you go back over? The real one and the fake one?
Yeah, then you figure out which is which and delete it. It's really annoying.
Wow, so this is really easier than using some other method of RSS reading, huh?
When it comes to the actual reading, there is nothing on this planet that comes within a million miles of NetNewsWire. It is only the fact that I insist on keeping it in sync across multiple Macs that is causing trouble, and it's only because those nasty evil people in NewsGator decided to kill their perfectly functional, bug-free, well-ironed-out syncing service they spent years getting right.
Have you written to them?
Yeah. They have a feedback button right in the help menu right within the app.
And have they given you any kind of answer to any of that?
I didn't get an answer to any of my feedback emails, but they also have a separate button called Report a Bug, and I've reported a few bugs, and I have heard back from the developer on one bug, and I replied back to him again and said, if you want more info, just ask, but I haven't heard back again.
Hmm.
So I imagine the poor man is being somewhat overwhelmed, because NetNewsWire is a very popular app with very passionate users. So I don't think I'm the exception here. So I think there's a lot of people chatting.
All right. So keep us posted on whether you like it or hate it each week, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
So you're going to use it. It works essentially, but you're grumpy the entire time.
Yeah. I'm going to have to figure something out, but every time I try another app, when it comes to the actual reading of the news, none of them are as good.
Maybe you should write one.
I don't have time to write. I have all that reading to do.
There you go, of course. All right, let's move on to our main topic, actually.
Yeah, this sort of occurred to me. We've talked a lot about website security, Soph. We've talked a lot about WordPress security in particular. And we sort of made assumptions while we were doing our talking that everyone knew what a web server was and how a web server worked, which in hindsight was really stupid of us.
I suppose we're not keeping up with our normal premise of making things easy to understand, right?
Yeah, we're assuming that the entire Nosillacast listeners are sysadmins, which, I mean, it works for me, but that's about it.
So we're going to start back at the beginning.
Myself and my wife, two of us would be fine. But, you
know. Right, right.
So this occurred to me because one of our regular listeners, fantastic listener Debbie, has unfortunately had another security issue on her blog, which she blogged about in detail, so you can check it out at what's Debbie's URL?
Splashofstyle.com.
Okay, I wasn't
That's
sure if it was
Debbie
common.
Debbie T.
So Debbie blogged about it, so I'm not revealing any horrible secrets here, and she said we could talk about it if we wanted. But in talking to Debbie about how things could have gone, I suddenly realized that we just jumped over a whole, like, we didn't lay any foundation. We went straight to building floor 4.
Okay.
So I thought we'd just really step back and actually talk about what is this web server thing, which I guess a lot of people look at as being a black box. And if you only know it as a black box, you don't really know what's going on. So I think it's time we took the lid off the box.
All right. So start at the beginning for us.
Right. A web server is just plain, ordinary computer running some sort of operating system and a couple of programs. Usually it's Linux, as it happens. Sometimes it's Windows. Very rarely it's even Mac OS X. But it can be any operating system. And in fact, you can turn your Mac into a web server by simply going to your system preferences, going into sharing, and enable the web sharing service. And then you have a web server.
And there is nothing. I believe you don't recommend that, though.
Well, in order for that to actually work, you would need to have your Mac straight on the internet and not behind a router, and then you're into all sorts of problems.
Right.
But for working within the house, it's a great way to test stuff, actually. Oh. Test it locally.
Okay.
But yeah, so there is nothing, it's not something special. It is a plain, ordinary computer running a regular operating system, and all of the users who can use that web server to put their website on it have an account, and it's just as if you went into system preferences and created accounts for all those people. So on a shared web server, there might be 3,000 people who also have accounts, but they're just regular user accounts like your user account. Now, as it happens on the web server, they don't let you access a GUI, but they could. They just don't enable it. You have a home directory just like you would on your Mac or your Windows machine or a Linux machine. So it's no different to the machine that you're sitting in front of now or whenever you go home and sit in front of machines. It's just an ordinary computer. You have an ordinary user account and all the usual rules apply.
Okay.
So that's probably the most important point. So the actual bit that does the web serving is just a program. It's usually a program called Apache, which is free and open source and rocks. Sometimes it's a program called IIS made by Microsoft. But it's just a plain, ordinary program that's no different to any other program you would run on your Mac. All it does, this program, this web server program, is it sits there and it listens on port 80, doesn't really matter what port it is, and it waits for some web browser somewhere on the planet to say, hello, Mr. Web Server, I would like this URL, please. The web server then looks at the URL and says, oh yeah, I know about that, that's here. So it reads off the first bit and it says, www.podfeet.com. Oh, that's the user A. Sheridan, I'm just guessing here. Okay, so that website is actually this folder in that user's home directory. And so I'm going to simply take everything after the slash. That's going to be a file name in that folder in that user's home directory. And all the web page is a bunch of files in your home directory on a regular computer.
Now, Bart, I've been running, not running a web server, but sharing time on web servers, and I've never heard it explained that way. That really does simplify it.
Now, at its very simplest level, when you ask it for a .html file, it simply goes into the appropriate folder in your home directory, takes that file, and sends it through the internet at the web browser, and that's all it does. If you ask it for a JPEG, it just takes the file off disk, sends it through the net, and out it pops in the web browser. That's all that's going on. There's a slight extra complication in something called a script, and it's only a slight complication. The URL still specifies a file, only in this case it's called index.php or whatever, And instead of actually sending the file through the internet, it runs the file, which is a program, and the output of the program gets sent through the internet and is displayed on your web page. The output of the file will be some HTML, which is then displayed by your web browser. So that's as complicated as it gets.
Is that, no, I don't want to take us down a rat hole here, but it might, you've explained to me a lot of some of the languages that we use to create things in WordPress actually aren't exactly what gets sent to the website. What actually gets sent to the website is HTML. So sometimes you're working on things that render, that create that HTML.
Yeah. That's exactly what I'm talking about here.
Okay.
So the .php file is a program that's executed by the web server, and the output of that program is what gets sent instead of the code.
Yeah, that was huge. I remember the day you explained that to me. We had been trying to do it in text back and forth, and I finally said, Bart, we got to get on Skype and have a conversation here. And we talked for like 2 hours before I had the epiphany of what you were talking about there.
That one epiphany is all. That's as hard as it gets in terms of what web servers do. That's the big thing. So either they just give back a file, or else they give back the result of executing a file. That's all they do.
Okay.
Now, obviously, you would like to get your programs, your files to and from the web server. So as well as running the Apache process or the IIS process, that program that simply spits out web pages, it also runs another program which is called, well, it can be called anything, but it's either an FTP server or daemon, they're usually called daemons, or a secure FTP daemon. And that's just a regular program that sits there and waits for your FTP client, say Transmit or
CyberDuck.
CyberDuck, or if you're a Windows user, FileZilla is a fantastic free one.
Right.
It waits for that program to connect to it and then lets you push and pull files to and from your home directory on the server, which is exactly the same as going into your Mac and into System Preferences and enabling FTP sharing. It's exactly the same as that.
Now, just so people get the real simplified version of that, I think it was way back in the command line days that the whole idea of put and get. Basically, you get in an FTP client, you get two windows. On the left-hand side, they usually put your stuff, and on the right-hand side, it's called their stuff. And I forget which program actually. It might be, I'm not sure if it's FileZilla or Transmit.
Transmit does it. Uses that phraseology, their stuff and your stuff.
It's just perfect because you know which one you're messing with. And you simply can drag and drop from your stuff to their stuff.
To their stuff. And yeah, the more traditional definition is local and remote, which isn't quite as nice as your stuff and their stuff. I think that's a fantastic idea by Transmit. It really simplifies it.
Right, right, right. So when I'm doing that, I'm taking this one file and I'm just dragging it from what looks like a Finder window onto the web server. In the background, it's executing this FTP program.
Yeah.
Or protocol or program.
It's a program that talks in the FTP protocol.
Got it. Okay.
So it understands FTP.
So FTP sounds all fancy and scary, but it's just puts and gets.
FTP is a human readable protocol because in the bad old days, you didn't have a GUI. You typed FTP at the command line.
Mm-hmm.
And you actually typed get space file name and hit return. Put space file name and hit return. Or list directory just to have it tell you what files there were and change directory. So CD to change local directory, sorry, CD to change on the server and LCD to change locally. And it was just a command line thing. So the actual FTP commands are all human readable.
But that was actually good terminology too, right? Put and get. I won't put it there. I won't go get it.
Get it. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And then later there was mput, which is multiple put. So mput let you do star.jpg instead of having to type put
that's over
image
the,
one.
That's
put
scary.
Image
that's,
two.
That's way over the top of my head.
But no, it used to be horrible because you used to have to type put for every single solitary file.
So input was a big step.
Imagine uploading a gallery of 40 pictures, or if you took them, 400.
Stop. I Bart my photos. I just don't Bart with a scalpel.
Yeah, so again, the FTP server running on that web server is just another program running on just a regular computer, probably running Linux rather than OS X or Windows, but it's just a computer running some programs. The final program that's probably running, because it's if you want to deal with information quickly and efficiently, text files isn't a good answer. It's a very poor answer. So if your program, if your blog or whatever wanted to store information, it could write them all out as text files and put them in your home directory and then read them back in when it needed them. But that would be very inefficient, very hard to search, very, very inefficient for doing that kind of stuff. So instead, a lot of web servers run a third program, and it's just a database server. And all a database server does is it lets you put information in and lets you suck information out. Well, that's it.
Okay.
So the big final picture, you type in the URL, goes off to your web server. Your web server uses the first bit of the URL to determine whose home directory it's going to go looking in, then the file bit to determine what file to go and fetch or execute. And if that last file is a PHP file that happens to be Allison's WordPress, that file will run, a little program will run, and one of the first things that program will do is connect to the local database to suck out the latest copy of the NoSillaCast. I give that back to the script, which then makes it nice and HTML-y and pretty, and then barfs it out to the web server. And that's it. That's all that's going on.
No, I used to be scared of the word database because I understand like what Excel is, where it's got rows and columns and data inside that. But when I heard database, I was just like, oh, that sounds big, scary, complicated. But it really...
Exactly. Lots of Excel sheets. Literally, no, I'm not being facetious. That's actually what it is. A table in a database is exactly the same as a single sheet in Excel.
Oh.
It's got rows and columns.
Well, that makes
me
feel better.
And the only extra thing is that in a database, you don't have one page, you have many pages, and you can specify relationships between the pages. So this, anything you put in this column here matches this column and this other sheet. So whenever I say UID of A. Sheridan, if I want to find out more about that username A. Sheridan, I take that same column and I put it into, I'll do a lookup on it on this other spreadsheet, and it'll tell me like that A. Sheridan is Allison Sheridan with email address, whatever and whatever.
Okay.
So it's just Excel sheets that link, that reference each other. That's all a database is.
So when you
and
look
it has
at
a language, which makes it easy to ask the spreadsheet questions.
Efficiently.
And that language is called, yeah. Well, not just efficiently from a computer point of view, efficiently from a brain point of view.
Hmm.
SQL is a wonderfully English language.
Wait, what's SQL?
It's the standard querying language, i.e. it's the language you use to ask questions of your multiple spreadsheets. And it's really Englishy. The first thing is, the first statement is select, where you tell it what you want. The second statement is from, where you tell it what tables to use. And the third statement is where you give it some conditions. So a perfectly valid statement would be select star, meaning everything, from WordPress under WP underscore users, where username equals A. Sheridan. And that will give me back all the details about you.
So that's a standardized set of commands that everybody in the universe has agreed to use?
Every SQL server understands SQL. So that is the language database servers use to talk. And there's another command called insert, which lets you insert data. There's another command called update, which lets you change a record, or a row, in other words, because a record is just a row. And there's another command called delete or drop, which allows you to either remove a row or drop an entire sheet. Drop is dangerous.
I have done it before, but I only do it with at least two other people in the room going, yes, Allison, you're okay. You're allowed to do that.
Yeah, delete from is another scary one when we're doing... I mean, I spend a lot of time at an SQL prompt in work, actually writing in raw SQL, because it's a beautifully simple language. If I want to get information out, you know, you just do it from the command line through SQL. It's really quite powerful. But I hate when I have to do a command like delete star from users where some condition, knowing if I get the condition wrong, you know, 6,000 user records can be destroyed.
Yeah, those commands are really scary. Before we get too far, I want to correct you. SQL stands for structured query language, not standard query language.
Oops.
I
got that wrong in my degree.
Is that on your diploma?
Yeah, but yeah, it's nice and standard, thank goodness. So there's a bunch. The most common open source SQL server program is something called MySQL, which you can run on the Mac if you want. There's another great one, which is actually more powerful than MySQL, but it's not as well known. It's PostgreSQL from Postgre. And then Microsoft have one too called SQL Server.
Now, MySQL runs on, it runs definitely on OS X and on Linux. Does it also run on Windows?
Windows does indeed.
Okay, that's cool.
So you often hear people talking about LAMP, the LAMP stack. Did you ever hear that phrase?
Yes.
So what that means is the web server is running Linux, the web serving program is Apache, the database is MySQL, and the scripts, the files sitting in the home directory, are either PHP or Perl. That's LAMP. Linux, Apache, MySQL, and PHP or Perl. The other one you'll hear is MAMP, which is Mac OS X, Apache, MySQL, and PHP or Perl. And the other one you hear is WAMP, which is Windows, Apache, MySQL, and PHP. You don't usually have Perl on WAMP.
You know, if someone jumped in right there, they wouldn't think you were making a lot of sense. Wow. No, I think you goaded me. It was either you or possibly research assistant Niraj goaded me into loading MAMP at one point. It was very interesting because I could actually experiment with things all completely locally. Again, using my Mac as a web server, but I was just doing it all inside this little sandbox I built here. And that was pretty interesting.
MAMP is one bundle, one PKG file that contains the MySQL program, the Apache program, and all of their configuration and everything, as well as a little GUI for turning those programs on and off, and it makes it look like one simple Mac app. It's actually really nice.
That is very cool. I want to take us back for just a second, just because I think it's interesting in a completely other dimension. The MySQL thing is very, very interesting because, as Bart said, it's open source, but it was actually created originally by Sun Microsystems, correct?
No, it was bought by Sun Microsystems.
Oh, okay. Well, we'll go with bought by Sun Microsystems, but the reason...
Yeah, it was bought by Sun, and the big worry is that who's buying Sun?
Well, that's what... Yeah, so Sun is being bought by Oracle, and one of the things that's been interesting is watching how MySQL has started to supplant Oracle's massive, expensive database program. So that's going to be very interesting. Now, there are people who believe that what this gives Oracle is the ability to work the low end and the high end of the same market, that it gives them products in both directions that are, you know, for the full gamut. There's other people who think, okay, they buy Sun and they go, okay, no more MySQL.
They can't. It's open source.
Yeah.
Thank goodness.
Right.
So
right.
If they try to kill MySQL, it'll simply brand. It'll fork and there'll be a new database called something else using the MySQL code.
Yeah.
And it'll develop forward and the butchered, destroyed Oracle version of MySQL will just languish and die.
If they were to do that. But maybe they're smarter than that. Larry Ellison doesn't appear to be an idiot.
No, I don't think he is. And I think upsell is the key here. You imagine having a company with the power of Oracle helping you get set up in databases and you get it side up and going and you have a couple of million records and all as well. But suddenly you have performance issues. And really, you've outgrown MySQL. Who are you likely to go to if Oracle have been so good to you to help you with that? You're going to go to Oracle, aren't you?
Right. Well, and it also could be an advantage for the MySQL community, just like you can get Linux through Red Hat, where, you know, it's an open source tool, but you can buy it through Red Hat and you can get all this lovely support and people to take care of you and pat you on the little pumpkin head
You don't read my tweets very often, do you?
Oh, do you hate Red Hat?
We use Red Hat in work. Red Hat is great, but their support is not what you use. Their support is pants.
Oh.
In my humble opinion. But no, it's a very good distribution.
Okay, in theory. In theory. Perhaps not in execution. That wasn't a good example.
But no, that's exactly it. And the other nice thing is, I mean, MySQL doesn't write itself. Programmers have to write it. So if Sun are paying those programmers, or Sun/Oracle are paying those programmers wages, then they can do more programming because they won't be hungry.
There you go.
Anyway. I just wanted to summarize where we've gotten to so far, because then we're about to make a leap into, so what's the problem? Because so far we've just been describing what shared hosting is. We're about to run into the, so why is this dangerous?
Yeah, you haven't used the word shared hosting in this context yet, so maybe you want to explain what
so
you
this
mean.
Is shared hosting because it's not the case. You could set up a server that you own where you install MySQL, you install Apache, and you install some sort of FTP server, and you're the only person who uses it. In that case, there's one account, which is you, and there's one version of Apache, which is only doing your bidding. But that's not how most people work. That's what a dedicated web server is.
So you can either do that yourself or pay a ton of money for that.
Yeah, so it's one server, one Apache, one person. So it's all to yourself. No sharing involved of any sort. Mm-hmm. That's not really affordable for most people. So what most people do is they buy shared hosting. So it's not just a desktop computer running Linux. It's a really stonking big computer running Linux. Mm-hmm. And I mean, you know, 32 gigs of RAM or more. Stonker of a machine with 16 CPUs or something. And it's running Linux, plain ordinary Linux. You have an account in it, as do 5,000 other people. So you have a home directory, they have a home directory. And you have websites, they have websites. They're just files in home directories. One Apache program is running on that server. It's taking a lot of RAM and a lot of CPU, but it's still one program. And that one program is serving out all of those websites. So that's what shared hosting is.
Okay. It isn't necessarily 5,000. He's just throwing a number out there, guys.
Big. It's very rare nowadays. The way you scale is you scale by having big stonking servers and getting lots and lots of customers on them to pay the bills.
And it's actually a pretty good idea if you think from a wasting of energy perspective and wasting of physical resources. Especially if you look at something like web serving, when you can get $3 or $4 a month, you can get web hosting from somebody like GoDaddy, and now you've got, I would probably guess that 90% of those people stand it up, play around for a few months, and then they're done. Or they get six people to their website a month. That's an extremely efficient way to distribute the cost and the energy usage. But
it's also really efficient on sysadmins.
Yes, exactly. Because they're only updating one version of Linux, one version of Apache.
One MySQL.
Right.
For 5,000 sites. And I'm not exaggerating that 5,000 number. That's quite reasonable for a shared server.
Okay. So what's the problem? So, it sounds lovely.
Sounds lovely, except for the fact that it's one Apache, lots of people. I was going to say too many chiefs and no Indians, but too many Indians and only one chief.
Going with the Apache Indian thing, great.
So the program, the Apache program, needs to be able to read all of your websites, because otherwise it can't serve them up to people. So if it can read yours, the same Apache program can also read everyone else's. And when an Apache program executes a PHP script, it runs as that Apache program.
Okay.
Which has read access everywhere.
It has write, doesn't it? Or it has just read?
No, it always has read. By default, it has read if you don't do anything strange. So we leave write out of it for now. Now, what's in... There's a file in WordPress called wp-config.php. Mm-hmm. What does it contain?
I forget.
It contains the username and password for your database.
Ah, right. I knew that.
So someone could write a script which simply goes to your home directory and reads out your config.php and doesn't execute it, it simply reads it.
Right.
You could write a PHP file to do that. You put that PHP file into your own web space and then you read Allison's wp-config.
Okay, which
means...
And you
can't be stopped because there's one web server user which is executing your script, but that one same web server has to be able to read Allison's, otherwise podfeed.com doesn't work.
Okay.
So there's no way to protect yourself from having your files read by everyone else you're sharing your server with. Mostly, that's fine, because people aren't buying space on web servers for the purpose of being naughty. They're buying space on web servers for the purpose of putting up their website. But if one Muppet you share the server with doesn't apply patches, then suddenly it's not the guy who bought the web server who's reading Allison's wp-config, it's the bad guys.
Hmm.
So compromising one endangers everyone else who's sharing.
Okay.
It's one web server.
Okay.
Now, we go a step further. If you're writing a blog post in WordPress, it would be really annoying to have to take out your FTP client, upload the file, and then manually type in img src equals, and then the URL to the image you just uploaded. That would be a pain in the backside.
Mm-hmm.
So WordPress allows you to make a folder called uploads in the wp-content folder and set that to be writable by the web server. So then you can just use the web interface to upload files, because the web server can now write files in that folder. But if your PHP script can write files, they're running as the one and only web server, anyone else's PHP script anywhere else on that shared server can also write into your wp-content/uploads folder.
Hmm.
Which is what happened to poor Debbie.
Oh, okay.
She found a bunch of stuff that was not hers sitting in her wp-content/uploads folder.
Interesting. So
that's why having write access is so dangerous on a shared server. If it's a dedicated server, it's only you. There's one Apache for just you.
So but you can't.
I don't know other users to get hacked and to read your data. It's only you, so you're safe.
But if you're on a shared hosting service, and you have that uploads folder, and you need to use that uploads folder, you must have it set to write.
But there's only one web server, so everyone else also has write permission on that.
Hmm.
Now, people get confused, because if you log in to FTP on your server, you do not see everyone else's files. You only see your own files, because you are logging in as you.
Right.
But the web server program runs as the web server user, and it has to be able to see them all, otherwise it cannot serve the web pages.
Ah, I see.
So you can't, But whenever you put up a script and that script runs, it doesn't run as you, it runs as the web server. And the web server has to be able to see and write, otherwise it can't do its work.
Well, so how does bad guy...
That's only one web server.
How does the bad guy run as the web server?
The bad guy just... If the bad guy can create a file called anything.php and then go to a web browser and browse to it, then he can run any code he likes. Because browsing to something.php executes something.php.
I lost you.
Okay. We're saying that if you go to a URL, it's just going to a file that's sitting in someone's home directory.
Sure.
If that file is a PHP file, the web server runs the file and gives you the output.
Okay, so I would, as a bad guy, I would create an account on the shared hosting server and I would put my nasty little script in there and then I would navigate to that on the web browser and that would execute it, which would have it go do its nasty tricks.
Exactly. And you would, because you've gone to it in a web browser, it's the web server deals with it, the web server runs it, so it has the web server's permission.
So are we all doomed? I mean, if we don't want to spend $70 a month on
It's not that we're doomed. It's just that if you want to spend cheap hosting, you need to be aware that that's what you're paying for. So you have to do backups because your security depends on everyone else's security. So you are at more risk and you can't protect yourself from that risk. So you just simply accept it and take your appropriate backup so that when the worst happens, you can recover.
Well, let me ask another question, and this may not work for anybody but me, but hey, it's my show. I can ask what I care about.
Sure.
I create my everything that goes on my blog is created using Feeder. So yes. When I'm writing my show notes, I'm happily writing along, and let's say I'm going to talk about the Zoom H2. I go find a picture of the Zoom H2. I FTP it up to a folder for the appropriate week's episode, and then I put in the HTML in order to talk to show that picture. I format how it's going to look. I don't ever use that upload folder. If I just set the privileges on that upload folder to nobody can ever do anything with it, am I safe?
You are safe from anyone writing to your account. What you can't protect yourself from is people reading your files.
Okay, but reading just means they can steal it, right?
Reading means they can steal it, and it also means they can steal your database login details and then mess up your blog that way. But they can't write their own programs into your website, which is good, because that means they can't use your website to distribute their malware.
Okay.
Which is good. You want to avoid that, because that's actually the target most of these bad guys have. They're not trying to steal your stuff. They're not trying to kill your site. They're actually trying to subtly, without your knowledge, sneak in a teeny tiny bit of their own code, which happens to be some sort of malware. So they want your site to stay up, and they want you not to notice. So they don't destroy your site. They don't cause you horrible headaches that way. They just insert their own little payload so that all of your visitors suffer.
So when you talk about doing backups, I use a tool called WP-Backup as a plugin for WordPress. And once a week, it sends me a backup of my, I believe it's a backup of my SQL database because it's a .sql file. So that would pull all of the text I've typed in my case, not the images because it's not, because I'm FTPing the images and just pointing to them. But if I were using the uploads folder, would it pull those?
Nope.
So the uploads folder is not included as part of the natural backup.
No, all it does is it actually issues a command to the database called MySQL dump, and literally makes the database barf out the MySQL commands to recreate itself.
Okay. So
it's actually a really good idea of doing a backup. So if you open that backup, you'll actually see it has a command create table, and then it says insert into table Allison's first post, insert into table Allison's second post. So just a bunch of create and insert commands which result in the same database you have now. It's a really cool idea.
Okay. But if you have been using that folder for the uploads, you should take a copy of that once a week too. What else do you have to go get? That's not all your files. Like your theme files wouldn't be updated, backed up either. So you probably, if you haven't messed with your theme for a while, take a copy of that, right?
It depends on how you do things. I have a copy of everything locally, and I make my changes locally, and then I FTP up a copy to the server. So if my site was destroyed, I would actually have all of my themes and everything locally, because that's where I edit them.
Okay.
The only thing I'd be missing would be the uploads folder in the database. So I have a backup script that copies the upload folder in the database every day at midnight.
So
every day at midnight I have a snapshot, and so I could restore to that point.
Does that script run on your web server? Or is it running locally?
Yeah, I have a dedicated server, so the rules are a bit different.
Okay.
But yeah, I have a script that runs on my web server and pushes them to a different server I also own.
Interesting.
So it just runs, it takes a snapshot and pushes it over to another server.
So we're partway there.
Yeah, it's the important thing is to be aware that you can't actually protect yourself from this. This is why it's such cheap hosting. It comes with a downside.
Yeah, it's but the order of magnitude price difference. I mean, I literally am spending, I don't know, it's like $4 a month, and to have dedicated, or even to have virtual dedicated, is more like
virtual dedicated is about 30, 38, something like that.
Yeah, maybe in your world.
I'm pretty sure GoDaddy have a VDED package for about $38 a month.
Actually, that's like describe the difference. Go ahead and describe the difference between a dedicated server and a virtual dedicated server.
Okay, remember, a web server is just a computer like your own. If you go onto your own computer and you install something like VMware or VirtualBox or Parallels, and then for every customer, you make them their own virtual machine and you run all of those. Those little machines inside are virtual dedicated servers.
Okay, so that takes away the advantage, say, to the sysadmin. You've actually got 10 separate installations of Linux, Apache, MySQL, and PHP for each one of those.
It's web servers within a web server.
Okay.
But of course, the sysadmin running the virtualization server doesn't have to manage the individual little web servers, because that's the responsibility of the poor sucker who buys them.
Okay.
They just manage the big server that runs VMware and make sure VMware keeps going.
So wait a minute. So if I did a virtual dedicated server, I would have to manage the Linux installation?
Sure. Yep.
I'm not going to do that.
See, that's the other downside.
Everybody who didn't think Bart was crazy before we started, he's crazy. I'm not going to.
No. The other option, which is the ultimate option, the best option from a security point of view, is don't run your own blog. Let the people at WordPress do it. They have one server, which they admin. Actually, no, it doesn't help either. Never mind. No, there's just, if you want to be secure, you need to be a sysadmin. And it's just not realistic. So you just do your backups and you realize and accept that reality. But that's why a corporate website should never be on shared hosting.
Right.
Especially if that corporate website contains customer data.
Right, because you owe it to your customers to protect that.
Read it. Yeah, exactly.
By the way, Bart was right, though, even if he is crazy, on a virtual dedicated server on GoDaddy is $30 a month if you only buy it by the month, by the pound there. If you buy 24 months, it's like $24 a month.
Yeah.
But you're saying
You would have to manage Linux, which is actually surprisingly easy these days. Yum, update, enter. But it takes on a whole new set of skills, because now you're not only managing your own WordPress, you're also managing your own Linux. Exactly. So we get back to the point. Just do your backups and accept the risk. Know the risk, accept the risk, and make your plans based on that reality, and you're fine.
And the community will help you pick up and move on if you've done your backup job, right?
If you've done your backup. So I'm not saying that we should all go mad and do these things. I'm saying you should be aware of the reality. You cannot fully protect yourself. Know that, behave accordingly, and all will be fine.
I guess the one thing I do wrong, because I don't use that uploads folder, I create a folder every week for the new episode, and it's got all the JPEGs in there, is I've just got this massive number of folders. You know, I've got 230 some odd folders with individual pictures in each one. Mm-hmm. I suppose I should back that up. I mean, I've got it separately in my...
You should back it up, but you should maybe just keep a copy of the whole thing on your own hard disk in one place.
Well,
and then every week just copy up this week's folder that you've assembled locally, and then you have a local copy.
It is, but the other thing I do... the problem is there's more than just that in it, so all the audio files are in it. So if I copy it up, then I'm copying the audio files, and the audio files don't actually live on GoDaddy. They live over on Libsyn. I should probably keep the audio file someplace else.
You could, in theory, write a script that would upload everything that didn't end in .aif or .mp3 or .garageband, and leave those behind and FTP up the rest. You could, in theory, do that.
Well, yeah, it's not a weekly problem because I do it as I go and I want to be able to see how it's working. So I go, okay, here's a picture of Zoom H2. Let me, push it up. And then I look at it and go, it's too big. Let me resize it, real time while I'm working on it.
Drop shadow.
Yeah, adding that drop shadow. So that actually works for me on the upload. It's the backing it up, I had to recreate it.
Add one step to your workflow. When you're done, when you've pushed publish and the show is live, download the folder you've just uploaded into one place and put them all there every week. And then you have a local backup.
But then I have two copies of every JPEG because I already have it in a folder.
I guarantee you that the MP3 file for the show is bigger than all of your JPEGs put together.
Absolutely. Yeah, no question of that, especially since I get lazy when I have a lot of disk space. Like right now, I've got a bunch of extra space. I've got 75 gig available. I haven't thrown an AIFF file away in like 4 weeks, so those are a quarter of a gig a piece to a half a gig, depending on the size of the show.
So in a couple of hundred weeks, you have a problem.
Yeah. All right. Well, this has been really good. I've learned a lot. I asked Bart to go gentle on me, and he said the idea was to be able to take this down to a level that I don't think you said it this way, but that even I could understand.
Yeah, there is one slight extra minor security feature that some websites have, but I think we're just going to not talk about it because it's so rare.
Okay, la 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 on that one.
No, it's if you assume that your server is the way we've described, it might be a teeny tiny bit less unsafe, but only a little. And it would only
give us false hope.
It would only give protection from write, not from read. So all of the problems where everyone can read everything you put up there still exist. So it only gives a small amount of protection. It's very rare because it's a sysadmin's nightmare to maintain. And a lot of web hosts tried it because it is more secure. And then a lot of them have backed out of it since because it just doesn't work.
Okay, so we won't talk about it.
So we won't talk about it because, to be honest, the chances of you having it are very slim.
Okay. All right, Bart. Well, we better cut it off here. We've been going quite a long time, but people don't seem to get tired of chit-chat across the pond, so I didn't cut us off. But I think I'm going to now.
Very good. I don't know if I'm going to be around next week because in theory I still need to get home to my poor parents who haven't seen me in ages. So you're going to have a stand-in Belgian at some stage soon.
Right.
Who won't be Belgian, he'll be British. But
he works in Belgium.
But he works in Belgium, so it's all good. And Britain begins with a B as well.
There you go. All right, Bart, anyway, we'll talk to you soon.
Yeah, whenever it is. And until then, happy computing.
Well, I'm afraid it's getting to the end of the show. Luckily, it is a pretty long one. It's not quite the Nosilla Cast-a-thon, but it's pushing it. We're almost at an hour and a half. Those crazy people in the chat room are saying, yay, love long shows. You really should come over and join us in the live chat over at podfeet.com/live because you never know what's going to happen. Today, we had an exciting event where the chat room split off into these, Gita called it a net split. It split off in all these separate IRC chats and then all of a sudden it came back together. It was really scary and we had chats going all over the place and everybody, it was a mess. It was absolutely a complete mess, but it was a lot of fun. It was interesting. We had parallel universes going on. We had mini chatlets, as Connor would say. So anyway, you should come over and join us. It's a lot of fun. We have a blast in there. And the main thing is the crowd is really welcoming to newcomers. There's none of that my beach kind of stuff going on in our chat room. I should mention that the International Mac Podcast saved the day for a while. So we had these mini chatlets going on, right? We're trying to figure out what to do. Well, at one point, it ended up being Connor and I were the only ones in one room. And Connor said, well, let's go over to the IMP chat room. So we went over to impodcast.com/live. And we were able to all converge over there until suddenly the Ustream chat fixed itself. So thanks to the International Mac Podcast, it worked great. And by the way, I'm on one of the more recent International Mac Podcasts, so of course you need to go to it. Oh, I'm sorry. I said the URL wrong. They're correcting me in the chat room. Even as we speak, it's impodcast.tv/listen. Sorry about that. Let's see. I got corrected by Connor and Bart. Got about just about everybody yelling at me. So anyway, I'm on the show a couple shows ago, I think, and we had a lot of fun in there. So go check out iampodcast.tv. Anyway, keep up the dumb questions by emailing me at allison@podfeet.com and be sure to follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/podfeet. Thanks for listening and stay subscribed.